So, my client...
Actually, you can wait a couple of minutes.
I'm into it now, man. You do not interrupt a work of art in progress. I have the great privilege of having Greg as one of my close personal friends, and it's like having your own private historian, because not only is his access to the record of Mormonism non-parallel, without parallel, his facility in writing it, in thinking about it, and in analyzing it in a way that that is helpful to my faith, is a wonderful privilege. And as he works on the what I think will be the definitive biography of my prophet, the prophet who was the president of the church when I grew up, David O. McKay, who... How many prophets looked like David O. McKay? I mean, he looked like a prophet. And of course, he comported himself as a prophet. And the more I learn about him through the eyes of Greg, who has a wonderful access to the historical record, the more love and admiration I have for him. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing Greg this afternoon, and here he is, Greg Prince.
Janelle was wondering how she was going to introduce me and then didn't have to. But I told her that the most appropriate introduction I had ever received was Paul Edwards, some of you know Paul, former general authority in the organized church, who introduced me at a meeting of the John Whitmer Historical Association by saying Greg Prince is a pathologist, which explains his interest in Mormon history. Janelle also asked me to do a paper when I wasn't intending to do one, and I said I'll do the one I did last year out in Ogden. And that takes me back many years. Growing up in Southern California, one of my boyhood friends in Westwood Ward was Scott Bernhardt, whose father later became administrative assistant to Ernest Wilkinson at BYU. And after Scott moved to Provo in 1959, we lost track of each other until we met up as missionaries in southern Brazil. When Scott got back from his mission, my brother happened to be in his ward in Provo when he gave his homecoming talk. And he began by giving a 2.5-minute talk, saying at the end of it, "That has nothing to do with my mission, but that's the sixth time I've given the same talk in this ward, and I thought you'd like to hear it again." Another question was asked before this started, and I thought I'd address it to all of you. How did I get into this topic? I got into it through a series of events that still leave me a little bit stunned. Several years ago, the full-time mission president in the Washington, D.C. mission, Bob Bright, former candidate for governor of the state of Utah, lived in our ward and saw what I was doing on the topic of early priesthood and said, "I've got your next book for you." I didn't know exactly what he meant at the time. It turned out that what he meant was that his aunt was Claire Middlemiss. Claire was President McKay's private secretary for 35 years until his death. She never married, and she willed all of her papers to Bob, who was her favorite nephew. Bob had those papers sitting in his basement for several years and had never even opened the cover of them. But he said, "I don't know how to do this," assuming that I did. He said, "Will you take these papers and use them as a foundation for writing a biography of President McKay?" Those papers amount to 2 pallets full, approximately 80,000 pages, most of which have never been available to researchers in the past. So that's how I got into this, and I've expanded on her papers, as you will see. If there was ever a person in terms of social justice in our society for fairness, it would have been David O. McKay. Had it been up to him alone, he would have given the black the priesthood that quick. So spoke one general authority recently, one who was called by President McKay and who discussed with him the issue of ordination of blacks. In one sense, there is no surprise ending to the story of David McKay's relationship to blacks, for the policy of not extending the priesthood to black males was not changed until 8 years after his death. However, look upon that relationship only in terms of whether or not the policy was changed is to overlook the deep concern that President McKay had for blacks throughout his tenure as church president, and the administrative changes he enacted that moved in the direction of full inclusion signaled by the 1978 revelation. The question of ordination of blacks was often on McKay's mind, and on several important occasions over the 19 years of his presidency, it became a front burner issue for the first presidency and others of McKay's inner circle. Most notably, the weeks preceding McKay's death saw a furious exchange of actions and reactions by the two dominant general authorities, Hugh B. Brown and Harold B. Lee, as one sought to change the policy while the other sought to block his initiative, neither of them appreciating that their efforts were irrelevant to the question at hand. In a letter written in 1947 when he was second counselor to President George Albert Smith, McKay outlined his own views of the basis of church policy denying priesthood to blacks. He cited one scriptural precedent for the policy, the well-known verse in the Book of Abraham, but stated that the complete rationale lay in the pre-existence. Declaring that God does not act unjustly, he postulated that conditions in that premortal existence were linked to birth through black African lineage. He did not, however, invoke a, quote, less valiant in the war in heaven, end quote, argument, nor a curse relating to Cain, and thus differentiated his position from that of his more conservative colleagues. In a further departure from those colleagues, he allowed for the eventual reversal of the policy without restricting it to a post-mortal period. In its essence, McKay's 1947 position on the basis of the policy remained intact throughout the rest of his life, perhaps softening in the one respect that he may have rejected his earlier speculation about a link to the pre-existence. This was suggested in a 1961 news conference in England when, being asked by a reporter about the policy, he replied that it rested solely on the Book of Abraham. Quote, that is the only reason, he said, it is founded on that, end quote. Upon becoming church president in 1951, McKay became increasingly concerned not about the validity of the policy, but the fairness with which it was being applied. He was particularly focused on South Africa, where existing policy required male members desiring ordination to demonstrate first that all of their ancestry was non-African. In other words, guilty until proven innocent. The inability or unwillingness of white members in the South African mission to undergo such an ordeal had resulted in a critical shortage of priesthood to the point of compromising regular church function. In 1954, McKay traveled to South Africa, quote, to observe conditions as they are, end quote. Seeing the ambiguity and harm caused by the policy, he changed it on the spot, stating, unless there is evidence of Negro blood, you need not compel a man to prove that he has none in his veins, end quote. In other words, innocent unless proven guilty. He went on to say, I should much rather make a mistake in one case, and if it be found out afterwards, suspend his activity in the priesthood, than to deprive 10 worthy men of the priesthood. He notified his counselors and the Quorum of the 12 of this change after the fact, and received their unanimous endorsement. This willingness to make a mistake in the name of mercy characterized his attitude throughout the remainder of his life. Deciding on a case in 1963 in which a boy of possible but unproven black ancestry was ordained, he said, we shall face the Savior and tell what our decision is with a clear conscience. Hello, Chester. Good to see you again. Within weeks of his return from South Africa, McKay met privately with Sterling McMurrin, 1954. In the course of their conversation, to McMurrin's surprise, McKay told him that the church position on ordination of blacks was, quote, policy, end quote, and not doctrine, and that the practice would someday be changed. The distinction between policy and doctrine in McKay's mind was crucial, Yet it was misunderstood at the time by McMurrin, and much later by Hugh B. Brown, Harold B. Lee, and others in McKay's inner circle, resulting in a crisis shortly before McKay's death. McMurrin considered the conversation personal and did not make it public knowledge until the final year of McKay's life. Though McKay reiterated the message a decade later to newly sustained general authority Paul Dunn, he apparently never made a point of it to his counselors or members of the Quorum of the Twelve, as evidenced by their reaction to first learning of it in 1969. That McMurrin's and Dunn's accounts were accurate is without question, for McKay's son Llewellyn verified the story with his father in 1968. Furthermore, an examination of McKay's own record on the subject verifies that he used the word policy and not doctrine in referring to it. McKay chose his words carefully, and it is clear in retrospect that in using the word policy, he did not mean that the practice of priesthood denial could be reversed merely by administrative decision. Indeed, he always affirmed, both in public and in private, that it would take a revelation for that to occur. But he also affirmed that such a revelation could occur, and therein lay the distinction in his own mind. To him, a policy could be changed, albeit in this case only upon receipt of a revelation, whereas a doctrine could not be changed. The subtlety of that difference was not appreciated by his colleagues. That such a revelation was not received by McKay is clear. What is less clear, however, is that on multiple occasions he sought such divine intervention unsuccessfully. One general authority recalled him saying privately that he had prayed and pleaded with the Lord, but, quote, I haven't had an answer. On another occasion, his daughter-in-law, then a member of the primary general board, told him of her concern about the situation wherein black primary boys watched their white classmates being ordained deacons at the age of 12 while they were excluded. He replied to her that he had taken the matter to the Lord many times but had not received an answer, adding, I don't know why. The question of reversing the policy next arose in the context of a multi-year effort to open a mission in Nigeria, where thousands who had obtained LDS literature had requested baptism. In discussing the matter with his counselors in January 1962, McKay said the decision to open Nigeria was as crucial to the modern church as the decision to proselytize to the Gentiles had been to the ancient church. Aware of the logistical problems of trying to administer a Nigerian church without local priesthood, Hugh B. Brown suggested, I wonder if the time is coming we will give the lesser priesthood to them. Although declining to accept Brown's suggestion, McKay acknowledged that you can't deal with this in a proper way unless you change that policy. 9 months later, the First Presidency again discussed the possibility of extending the Aaronic priesthood to Nigerians, this time with McKay broaching the subject. Quote, if we could just give them the Aaronic priesthood, I suppose there is no way to differentiate. The Lord will have to do it. The Lord did that after the priesthood was taken away from the ancient prophets. That law was added as a schoolmaster to bring them to Christ, and that is all they had for hundreds of years. End quote. To this, Brown replied, I secretly hoped that the time would come when we could give them the Aaronic priesthood. The discussion ended with McKay concluding, as he always would, only the Lord can change it. The final chapter of this saga occurred in 1969. A college student by the name of Stephen Taggart wrote a monograph of the history of the church's policy toward blacks, and in researching the topic became aware of the contents of McMurrin's 1954 conversation with McKay, as well as Llewellyn McKay's report that President McKay had confirmed its authenticity. With the permission of McMurrin and Llewellyn McKay, he included this information in his monograph. A copy of the manuscript passed from Hugh B. Brown, first counselor in the First Presidency, to Lawrence McKay, oldest of President McKay's children. On September 10, 1969, 4 months before President McKay died, Lawrence and his brother Llewellyn, along with Alvin R. Dyer of the First Presidency, met with President McKay on the matter. It was the first that Dyer had known of McKay's considering the matter one of policy rather than doctrine. The concept was apparently new to Brown and to Lawrence McKay, who suggested to his father, quote, if this was not the time to announce that the Negro could be given the priesthood, and, quote, to do so now voluntarily rather than to be pressured into it later, end quote. Shocked at the apparent prospect of ordination of blacks, to which Dyer was vehemently opposed, he later wrote, I felt it my responsibility to make some comments concerning this vital matter. He thereupon launched into a lengthy and forceful rehearsal of all of the traditional arguments in favor of the ban on ordination, including one held by some of his conservative colleagues, but never embraced by President McKay, the, quote, curse of Cain, end quote. The immediate effect of Dyer's counteroffensive was to cause Lawrence McKay to abandon the topic. Said Lawrence, perhaps, Father, we had better leave this with you. You can think about it. Dyer, however, threatened by the prospect of a change in policy, scrutinized Taggart's manuscripts throughout the subsequent days. 1 week later, in a First Presidency meeting on September 17, 1969, Dyer pronounced Taggart's article, quote, one of the most vicious, untrue articles that has ever been written about the church, end quote. President McKay, in failing health only 4 months prior to his death, was not in attendance at this meeting. The events that unfolded over the subsequent weeks pitted two strong-willed leaders, Hugh B. Brown, counselor in the First Presidency, and Harold B. Lee, acting president of the Quorum of the Twelve, against each other. Viewed through the retrospective of 3 decades, we are able to see that this tragic confrontation of 2 great men was unnecessary, and that it occurred because both men, as well as Alvin R. Dyer, who appears to have borne the message to Lee, misunderstood the connotation of McKay's use of the term policy, which always assumed a mandatory linkage to new revelation if change were to occur. By contrast, both Brown and Lee interpreted the information in Taggart's article to mean that change could come through simple administrative action in the absence of revelation. Brown had felt as early as the 1930s that blacks should hold the priesthood, and in a 1963 interview with New York Times reporter Wallace Turner, he appeared to be pushing in that direction when he said, we are in the midst of a survey looking toward the possibility of admitting Negroes, probably in reference to ongoing discussions about taking the church to Nigeria. McKay had been displeased with Brown's comment and had privately chastised him when Turner's article was published. Given the hitherto unknown information in Taggart's article, Brown renewed his effort to have the ban reversed. 1 month after Dyer's first knowledge of the article, he and Brown met privately. Brown strongly advocated to Dyer that, quote, we should give the Negro the priesthood, that we had only one scripture in Abraham that suggested otherwise, end quote. Dyer strongly disagreed, later noting with disapproval that Brown, quote, had tried twice of late to get President McKay to withdraw the holding of the priesthood from the Negro, but President McKay had refused to move on it, end quote. In retrospect, of course, it is clear why McKay had refused to move on it, and that was that only a revelation could move him to do so, and he had received none. Brown misunderstood the crucial fact that absent such a revelation, not even he, as first counselor, could nudge McKay into changing the policy. Another who misunderstood was Harold B. Lee. Lee sided with Dyer in strongly opposing a change in the policy. Indeed, on more than one occasion, he indicated that McMurrin had apparently misunderstood McKay, that McKay, quote, would not have made a statement of this kind, end quote. Furthermore, in earlier years, he had said privately that blacks would not hold the priesthood as long as he was alive, a statement that ultimately proved true. Taggart article, combined with Brown's renewed efforts to persuade McKay to change the policy, presented Lee with what he interpreted to be the real threat of the ban on ordination being lifted. Had he understood McKay's usage of the word policy, he would not have reacted as he did. Convinced that the threat of change was both real and imminent, Lee moved to block such an eventuality. In an October conversation with N. Eldon Tanner of the First Presidency, he adamantly stated that he, quote, would not consent to any change of policy as respects the Negro problem, end quote. Interesting comment for a man who was not in the First Presidency, and indicative of the power that he wielded. In the ensuing weeks, he worked with the Quorum of the Twelve to draft a policy statement that would block Brown's initiative by reconfirming the church's ban on ordination of blacks. In its full version, the document began by implicitly acknowledging that there were differences of opinion as to the current status of the ban. Quote, in view of the confusion that has arisen, it was decided at a meeting of the First Presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve to restate the position of the church with regard to the Negro both in society and in the church, end quote. The document went on to set a backdrop for its central message. We believe that this work is directed by God and that the conferring of the priesthood must await his revelation. The intent of the document was thus to close the door on the possibility of reversing the ban through administrative action, as Brown had been attempting to do. The statement was highly unusual in that it came out over the signatures of two members of the First Presidency, Brown and Tanner, but was written by the Quorum of the Twelve. McMurrin noted that the letter, quote, was produced by leaders among the Twelve in response to my report set forth in the letters to the McKay brothers, end quote. And Dyer reported that, quote, Elder Lee had been the one who had prompted and directed the preparation of the policy article, end quote, which, while based on President McKay's prior writings and statements on the subject, contained no contemporaneous contribution from President McKay. It is worth noting that McKay was 96 years old, and in rapidly failing health, and that the statement was dated only 1 month prior to his death. Also unusual was the fact that the statement was released for distribution to church leaders by Harold B. Lee and not by action of the First Presidency. The statement, signed only by Brown and Tanner, was distributed to church leaders on December 15, 1969. No plans were made to publicize it until it became apparent that Wallace Turner of the New York Times had obtained a copy and planned to publish it, whereupon it was quickly published in the church news on January 10, 1970. The story does not end there. Christmas Day 1969, an article written by Lester Kinsolving of the San Francisco Chronicle was published in the Salt Lake Tribune. The article read in part, "The Mormon Church's denial of its priesthood to Negroes of African lineage, quote, will change in the not-too-distant future, end quote, according to Hugh B. Brown, one of the highest-ranking officials of the church." The article also disclosed that Brown had recently spoken to Willard Wyman, assistant to the president of Stanford University, stating, "The church is not prejudiced in any way but this one, but I think that will change." The day the article was published in the Tribune, Brown telephoned Sterling McMurrin and, quote, told me that he wanted me to know that he had signed the First Presidency document under great pressure, end quote. Brown's statement to the reporter from the Chronicle thus appears to have emerged from his frustration at being obliged to sign a statement that shut the door on what he had been striving to achieve. The following day, December 26th, Dyer met with McKay to urge that the statement now be published, and that three other signatures of First Presidency members, David O. McKay, Joseph Fielding Smith, and himself, be added to those of Brown and Tanner. By making such a release, Dyer wrote, it would counteract the confusion and misunderstanding that had developed because of the statements made by President Hugh B. Brown, as reported by Lester Kinsolving of the San Francisco Chronicle. Learning of Dyer's plan to publish the letter over five signatures, Harold B. Lee intervened and asked that the article not be published at all at that time, to, quote, lessen the possibility of further breach in the impression that President Brown had given, end quote. On his part, Brown had by this time qualified his statement by saying that it was his own opinion and not necessarily a policy statement of the church, and Lee felt that no further clarification was necessary. Wallace Turner, however, forced his hand, and the statement was published over only two signatures on January 10, 1970. 1 week later, David O. McKay died at the age of 96, and Joseph Fielding Smith became the 10th president of the church. For the first time since 1877, a counselor in the First Presidency was not retained by the succeeding president, as Hugh B. Brown was released, Harold B. Lee sustained in his place. The subject of the priesthood ban faded quickly from the front page as church members and Americans in general became more preoccupied with the Vietnam War and Watergate. It would not reappear until June 1978, when all of the principals of the events of late 1969 were deceased. For those who knew President David O. McKay personally or who were in the church during his lengthy and memorable presidency, there's no question that he possessed a Christ-like character rarely seen in our time. As stated at the beginning of this paper, it is the opinion of at least one general authority who knew him well that he would have moved quickly to change the policy if it were merely up to him. But it wasn't up to him, and he knew it better than anyone else, even better than his closest advisors. In a temple meeting in the mid-1960s, another general authority asked, "President McKay, will the time ever come, maybe in our lifetime, when the blacks will hold the priesthood?" McKay replied, "The question sounds like I make the decision. When the Lord tells me, then we'll do it." While he did not change the policy on ordination of blacks, there is no question that he always viewed all members of the church with compassion. In the case of blacks, this came through in several policy decisions he made. First, as mentioned earlier, he relaxed the rule governing ordination of men whose black African ancestry may have been suspected but not proven, thereby opening the doors of the priesthood to thousands, particularly in South Africa and Brazil. Second, he allowed blacks to be called to leadership positions in auxiliary organizations. Third, he allowed blacks to enter temples to be baptized for the dead. And fourth, on occasion, when children of black ancestry were adopted by white parents, he authorized those children to be sealed to their adopted parents. Of course, we are left to ponder why it was that the revelation he repeatedly sought did not occur until 8 years after his death. It is a question none of us is able to answer, but I close with the opinion of one member of the McKay family. The man was so tender-hearted. My own opinion is that it wasn't because the blacks weren't ready for it. It's because the church wasn't ready for it. Thank you. I guess we got time for questions. How much time do we have, by the way?
About 20
minutes. Oof. Brent.
Where was, during this crisis that happened in 1969, where was Spencer Kimball? He was, of course, in the Corps of the 12, but was he, do you get any sense for how, where he was with respect to this crisis?
He was out of the loop. Entirely, as were any current leaders of the church.
Can you sort of repeat the question?
The question was, during this crisis, particularly the late 1969, where you have all of a sudden this intense combat between Harold B. Lee and Hugh Brown, both of whom are misunderstanding what McKay's thinking really is, where was Spencer Kimball? The answer is, he wasn't. He wasn't part of the inner circle. There was an inner circle during the McKay years, and it was never very large. It consisted generally of his counselors, though not always, because in his later years, some of the counselors fell out of disfavor, Brown and Tanner being among them, and were effectively excluded at times from some of the decision-making process. If you want to know why extra counselors came in, there's your answer. It's not because he needed extra help because of the burdens of the job. Kimball was not part of the inner circle. The First Presidency counselors generally were. Harold B. Lee was at times, though it would be in and out depending on what the issue was. Joseph Fielding Smith was not, even though he was in the First Presidency.
And Dyer was an extra counselor. Didn't he become...
Isaacson and Joseph Fielding Smith were the first two of the... let me qualify that. The first extra counselor was Hubie Brown. And that was in 1960. We tend not to remember that one. We think of expanding the First Presidency. It was occasioned by the failing health of Reuben Clark. Brown was brought in as an additional counselor, and about 6 months later, Clark died, and thereupon Brown became the second counselor with Henry Moyle, the first counselor. In 1965, there was a crisis within the First Presidency that brought Thorpe Isaacson in through the back door as a de facto member, but not as an official member until October of that year. And then Isaacson was an official member of the First Presidency only for about 3 months before he had a major stroke and was never able to resume his duties. McKay hoped that he would recover enough to do that. and after about a year concluded that that wasn't going to happen, and that was when he brought Dyer in as an additional counselor. So you had, on the one hand, Dyer, in this particular historical context, Dyer and his cousin, Clara Middlemiss, Brown, Tanner, Lee. So it wasn't just two sides on this either. It was very complicated. But the whole thing was kept within very tightly contained circles. And even to this day, there are very few people who have any idea that any of this was going on. Yes, question up here.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier in your talk that you don't understand that it was only because of that verse in the book of Abraham. And then when Joseph Fielding Smith became president, there's a person in this room who asked Joseph Fielding Smith in person about that. Could you respond, Brother England?
Well, actually, it wasn't while he was president. It was while he was president of Quorum. And I asked him if he had to believe as a Latter-day Saint that blacks were unfaithful in pre-existence. He said yes. And I had more courage then, so I asked him to show it to me. And he went through those scriptures and said, when he got through this, well, you don't have to believe it because it does say that. But, you know, he went through those pro-great Christ scriptures and said, they don't say that. But he said, I've always believed it. It seems like a good idea to me. I've never prayed about it or had any revelation about it.
But by the time you see that this is all happening, that has been, in the language of scriptural studies, that's the received text. Not just the verse in Abraham, but the whole concept. Nobody questioned it. And then they go back occasionally when somebody raises an embarrassing question and they're trying to justify it, and that's not so edgy.
I wonder if you could tell me how these materials are going to become more widely available.
When I push them.
The reason I ask that is that I'm a little embarrassed. I have an article coming out in the current Sunstone, and I wish I'd had your material because I probably fell into the old trap a little bit. It's about Preston McKay and his place in Mormon culture. And I talk about broader issues, but I focus on this, going mainly on the evidence from Sterling McMurrin and Joel Binion about what he was doing behind the scenes, which was considerable. I think you're right about that. But I sort of deduced from that, from some of Norman Moss's comments, that in fact, one of the differences between him and Spencer Edward Kimball is that he, because of this distinction about policy, wasn't, at least with the Quorum, actively seeking a revelation, that he really did think that somehow it could come about in some other way. But you kind of straightened me out on that. I feel bad that I didn't have that information. But I tell us when you're going to put these where everybody can have access. Are you going to wait until you publish your biography?
This manuscript may come out in a year or so because a fellow out at University of Utah, Darren Smith, is putting together an anthology. He may have contacted Armin about it as well and asked for a copy of this, and I consented to send that out. Yeah. I was trying to think. No, up until about a month ago, they were on the first floor, but they're in the basement now. Not in this one. They are in a room that is a new wing of our house that was built specifically. Get the picture? Waterproofed, fireproofed.
Yeah. I don't appreciate your selfishness.
Unfortunately, I don't hold legal title to them, so I am somewhat constrained yet. They will. Yes, they will. When and under what circumstances, I don't know because I don't have control over that. Brenda's already under a death threat. Yes.
I remember basically reading at some point in the past that there had been a tentative decision, I think maybe in the early 70s, 71, by the Quorum of 12 to ban. This was while Harold E. Lee was out of town, and they reversed the decision after he got back in town.
The most likely source for that, and where I got the same story, was directly from Ed Firmage.
Yeah, I used that in my article, and I remember sitting on my front lawn in Palo Alto, in which U.B. Brown is quoted as saying, we're going to make a change.
Yeah.
Now, so it must be the same incident.
Well,
I remember thinking, oh dear, I bet this doesn't happen. And sure enough, the next day, there was a traction. So I guess that's when...
Well, Ed said right out, he said there was a meeting and McKay wasn't there. Brown pushed it through and it was approved by the Quorum of the Twelve. I don't know that that was the case. That may not coincide exactly with the historical record. I've not seen any independent confirmation of that. You do have the Dyer statement here that he's tried twice recently to change it, and that comes from Alvin Dyer's journal, so I think it's authoritative. But I don't have any other confirmation that there was a meeting in the temple of the quorum where Brown tried to push that through. So it's an open door on that yet, but that's probably the same source that you heard the story from. But it wouldn't have been 70 or 71, it was 69. Well, but Dyer's comment, though, is recently, and he's talking in October 69 at that point. Yes? No, it was his own opinion. It was his own opinion, but this is a... Oh, it was his own opinion, but this is a very well-thought-out opinion of a man who has a lot of both insight and integrity. He never said. He never said. It's interesting, in going through all of this material, President McKay was a very introspective man, but that introspection didn't move into the written record very often. And so you're left, usually, to try to infer on the basis of what others around him are saying, what he's really thinking, because he didn't tip his hand. There apparently was one man by the name of Earl Felt, who was a dairy farmer and a contemporary of his in Huntsville, who was his confessor. He would go up there and sit in the dairy barn, and while Earl milked the cows, he would drive his car up there fast, and that he would chat with them. But not even his own family members ever knew what he talked about, and Earl Felt went to his grave and never even told his family members what they would discuss there. So he held his cards fairly close throughout his life. And obviously in this case, because he had at least two occasions, McMurrin in 1954, Dunn in 1964, where he was candid with him and said, yeah, it's policy and it'll change eventually. But he never told that even to his own counselors or apparently to any members of the Quorum of the Twelve. And there's no question that he did tell those two men that, because his own son later affirmed it with McKay directly. Getting back, Brent, to your earlier statement, because it has occurred to me since you said that about Kimball, I talked to Ed Kimball, who is in the process of writing a second biography of his father that will cover his whole life. The first biography ended in 1977. There were a couple of things that happened in 78 that probably were worth writing about. But Ed has had access to his father's diaries, and I asked him just to look for things in there that might shed any light on the McKay biography. He looked and he said, I'm disappointed. He said, there's virtually nothing in there. The two men really didn't have very much interaction at all.
What position was Kimball, was what, third or fourth at that point in line of succession?
Probably. Yeah, I guess so, because it would have been Joseph Fielding and then Lee and then Kimball. Yeah. Yes. No, surprisingly. And I think that's a misconception. It's not unusual for a public policy to have a negative effect on the way that the leading councils will discuss something. They don't seem to show much eagerness to give the appearance that they were moved from here to there by public debate. But on this one, it never really entered their own discussions. Now, on the issue of civil rights, Sure, there were discussions among the first presidency and became a fairly heated issue. The statement that Hugh Brown gave in General Conference 63 or 64, June 64, in fact was written by Sterling McMurrin.
Which one?
It was occasioned really by the threat of the NAACP to boycott or to picket the General Conference. And McMurrin and Brown were working behind the scenes to try to do something that would defuse this situation. So Brown asked McMurrin to write this statement, ghostwrite it.
What was it?
It was a very conciliatory statement that encouraged the issue of civil rights. It tried to nudge the whole church in a direction of being more liberal in their outlook on this issue. And it did succeed in diffusing the immediate crisis, picketing General Conference. McMurrin wrote it. Brown took it to McKay. One sentence was deleted, and McMurrin told me that the sentence that was deleted should have been deleted. So he had no problem with that. But I doubt that he told very many people over the years. Did Sterling talk to you about it, Gene?
No, it's in his conversations with...
Okay. Yeah. Because my conversation with him was prior to that. He said, well, I've never told anybody this before, which has not been an unusual occurrence during my information gathering on this biography. A lot of people are saying things because they feel that there's historic importance now. Brent?
Is it the sense, as you go through the historic record, that David O. McKay, I mean, he gathered around him at various times very strong men of divergent opinions?
Yes.
Example, Dyer and Hubie Brown, both extremely strong, opinionated men, very divergent opinions. Was it McKay's style to let them fight it out and move in at the last minute and resolve conflict, or how did he, or is there any style?
It doesn't look like there was heated debate very often. He just didn't allow that to happen. What seems to have happened half behind the scenes. McKay has sometimes been characterized as a wishy-washy leader. He was not. He was subject to being influenced in his thinking by additional input, but he was not wishy-washy in the sense that he was afraid to take a stand on something. Quite the opposite. What he did do, and it was the bedrock really of his entire administration, and I think of his life, is that the most important principle to him appears to have been free agency. I've talked to you, I think, about the dinner in the White House. 1959, McKay came back. Benson was the Secretary of Agriculture, and I presume was the intermediary between McKay and Eisenhower. But there was a White House dinner attended by about two dozen leaders in industry, religion, military, education. McKay had the seat of honor directly across the dinner table from Eisenhower, and Eisenhower asked him to give the blessing on the food. In McKay's account of it, that's in the middle of Miss Papers, he says, after the prayer, the gentleman to my right turned to me and said, I was impressed in your blessing on the food that you dwelt at length on the subject of free agency. Interesting topic for a blessing on the food. And McKay's response was, yes, it is the most important principle in life. And he believed that and he followed that. At some point along the way, that could work against the interests of the church. Because in holding so firmly to the principle of free agency, he failed at times to rein in some of his subordinates when they should have been reined in, because he felt there was an overriding principle at issue here. And so,
would you like to talk now about Elder McConkie?
In fact, that one went for over a year before any kind of action was taken after Bruce McConkie's book was published. It's not that it hadn't appeared on the radar screen. It's that it wasn't a big enough blip for him to feel motivated to do that. And it's interesting that over the course of his administration, he seems to have had more of a problem with the right wing in the church than with the left wing in the church in terms of having to reel them in occasionally. He did act when it came to a crisis point, then he would pull them back in, and he tended to do it fairly precipitously and unfortunately with some casualties along the way. I still would prefer that to some of the other alternatives. I think on balance, he will always look pretty good. Yes?
I think Mike Quinn argues that on matters of political conservatism in the 50s and 60s, that McCain would say different things depending on the audience. And so my question is, do you find any evidence that McCain might have said different things to different members of the First Presidency, Quorum of the Twelve, or other general authorities, or at least perhaps say things that they may have interpreted in such a way that would lead them to lead some to believe that he was in favor of a more liberal practice and others that he wasn't?
The answer so far is I don't know, and the reason I say I don't know is that I'm trying to do the research phase of it systematically, and one big chunk, meaning about this big, consists of about a dozen notebooks of his collected discourses, many of which were not published. Clare was responsible for him probably being the best documented president in the history of the church. She worked on it night and day. She had from one to two full-time secretaries just working on compiling the record of his administration, scrapbooks, other types of records. This is the speeches, and I haven't started to go through those, and that's where it's likely to come out. So I don't know the answer to that yet. I do know that he was susceptible to being influenced based on the input that he had. And Claire was not a Bircher, but she certainly was in sympathy with them. She championed the cause of Ezra Vanson, and she gave McKay input at times that I think distorted where the Birchers were coming from. And on occasion, he had to then react later and pull back and come down hard on the Birchers because of their tactics. He clearly was a political conservative, no question about that, and was generally in favor of the stated mission of the Birchers to fight communism. But that's where the roads diverged. He was an ardent anti-communist going back to the 30s. It was not Ezra Benson who pushed him in that direction. He had his mind made up well before that. And it was influenced even before his presidency by some traumatic things that happened, one of the most being in 1950 when the Czech secret police arrested two LDS missionaries and held them for several weeks. The quid pro quo eventually was, we will release these missionaries if the church gets out of Czechoslovakia. And that was the end of the church in Czechoslovakia. Toronto was the mission president. They pulled out, the missionaries left, and stayed out for several decades. But McKay was right in the middle on that even before he was the church president, because he had the missionary work as part of his portfolio. So here were two families of these elders who were in jail, and McKay here, and Arthur Watkins is the senior senator trying to give him information, and Watkins working with the State Department. And all of this was very distasteful to McKay, and he remembered that. Not long after that, 1952, he was in Helsinki, shortly after the Helsinki Olympics, and remarked that everybody was on edge in Helsinki because the Russian fleet in the Baltic and heavily armed, and nobody knew whether or not there was going to be another shooting war that would start. Later, he was in Berlin for a church conference and was made aware of the fact that communist spies were seated within the audience just to make sure what was going on there. And all of these things he commented on as being very distasteful. So he didn't need Benson to push him into the corner of thinking that communism was not something we should espouse. Yes?
You said earlier that Brown and Helen Keller fell out of favor as counsel yeah. of Mr. President. Can you elaborate on that?
Not much yet. Had to do with church finances. Yes.
Greg, what's the difference between the collection that's in your possession and the McKay papers that are at the University of Utah Marriott Library in San Marcos?
Ah, okay. Big difference there. Those papers were donated by Joyce Bennett and Medina Anderson primarily, two granddaughters. Medina is the oldest of all of the McKay grandchildren. No, next to this. She's the oldest child of Lawrence. Dick McKay, who is Llewellyn's son, is the oldest grandchild. But when Lawrence was going to donate all of his papers to the church, and the church, in fact, microfilmed them in anticipation of that, just so they would have a permanent backup copy of them. When he wrote his biography of his father, called, I think the title is My Father, David O. McKay, which is a very, very nice tribute to his father. It's a good book. Levina Ghost wrote it with him. He was not given access to the papers of his father that the church had. And he, read in the introduction to that book, he's gentle in the way that he's saying it, but he's not sidestepping the issue. And what he's saying is, this is not the definitive biography because I wasn't allowed to see what's there. So he changed his mind not long before his death. And rather than his papers going to the church, they went to the University of Utah because he didn't want them to be put into a situation where they wouldn't be available for scholars. And he wasn't confident that would happen if he put them in the church archives. Those consist primarily of the earlier years of his father. There are quite a few handwritten diaries that go back into the early 30s. They don't have a lot of content. They would be like these little pocket diaries where you may have three or four lines available for any day, and he would often go weeks or months and not make any entries. But still, there are some useful things in there, but it deals very little with his years as church president. In fact, I'm not sure if there are any papers in there from his presidential years. There's a lot of stuff in there. A lot of correspondence that is mostly family-related correspondence that goes way back, clear to the early decades of this or of last century. But does that give you?
Yeah. So that's why
there's no overlap in the two collections.
So that's why the Scottish Mission period, the book on that comes from those papers.
Yes. Yes. There are two sets of important, extensive diaries mixed in with all those other personal diaries. One would be his missionary diaries from 97 to 99 in Scotland, and that's what Stan just published. And then the other would be the diary account of his world trip in 1920-21, which wasn't so much a diary as a collection of the letters that he sent home chronicling his travels with Hugh Cannon. That needs to be published, too. Stan says he doesn't have the energy to do it right now, but it should be published because it's a very important record.
Well, just to echo what Gene said earlier, which we pulled out in the book, that someday these papers might be united with those at the Marriott Library?
Well, whether they would be united would not be my decision. It would be the decision of Bob or his heirs, however they decide to do that. The when and the where of those papers' disposition is entirely theirs. I would certainly, along the way, encourage them and have encouraged them that eventually these should be made available to scholars. And I hope that they will, and I think that their disposition now is in that direction because they see them as a tremendously valuable resource that should be made available. And I can tell you firsthand, it's a gold mine. Yes? Yes.
Why does she keep his papers?
Well, she didn't keep, quote, his papers. There are, I don't know how many file cabinets, for instance, that are his, quote, official papers, meaning correspondence and all this kind of stuff. There are 215 scrapbooks in the church archives that are available for researchers to look through that she kept. And there's a variety of other records. She also kept copies of some of those scrapbooks and other things that they don't have and copies of other things that they do have. I don't have access to all of what the church has to be able to make any comparisons. So, you know, how much of what is here is duplicated by this? I don't know.
I'd be happy to do the comparison.
Any insight into David O. McKay's relationship with his niece?
A major chapter of the biography, whether it goes by this title or not, I'm not sure, will be tolerance. And there are some marvelous examples in his life of tolerance. One was Juanita Brooks, whose church membership he saved with three words to Delbert Stapley, who was the emissary from the 12 to try to get her excommunicated: leave her alone.
After Mount Meadowness.
Yes. And I have that from a former stake president to whom Delbert Stapley told the story. And I have it. He wrote a whole manuscript on that that he never published that he sent to me. Another one would be Sterling McMurrin, where upon finding that Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee were heading an effort to have McMurrin excommunicated, McKay intervened, had a one-on-one meeting with McMurrin that's well documented in Jack Newell's book, where the bottom line was, well, if they put you up for your membership, I will be the first witness in your defense. And that one went away. And there are several other instances of that, of his being a large enough man and having a large enough tent for the church that everybody had room inside of it. The one aberration to that I have seen comes with Ron Brody. Now, I don't know how much, if any, contact they had once he became the president of the church, except for one occasion, and that was in July of 1951. He became church president at General Conference in April. In fact, George Albert Smith died during General Conference. In July, McKay went to Ogden and spoke at a 4th of July breakfast and then drove up the canyon to Huntsville for a family gathering. And he reports in there, I got out of the car and who should I meet but Bernard and Fawn. He said, I shook hands with and greeted Bernard, but I couldn't bring myself to speak to Fawn. That's the only thing that's in there about her. But it's so uncharacteristic of him. But there was one instance where it crossed the line. And I don't know if his feeling towards her was that she had betrayed the church or that she had betrayed Tommy, his younger brother, and his favorite brother. There's no indication as to what was behind that. But that's the one instance where he steps out of character and just can't get over that.
What do you mean? Yeah, betrayed Tommy.
Well, her father was deeply hurt when she published No Man Knows My History.
He apologized to church.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very traumatic. I think the best insights in that would be in Newell Ringhurst's biography of Fawn, where he goes into that in much more detail than I will. Because the focus of mine is going to be David O., not Thomas. But Thomas and David O. were very close. And I just, trying to read between the lines, wonder if his viewpoint, or his view of Fawn, was somehow clouded by his perception that she had brought dishonor to her father. Don't know.
Well, let me go on record here by saying, he is the witness I would
like
to take in Sterling after his case.
Yeah.
I represented Fawn, I didn't represent her, I was talking to her about the placement of a chapel in Pacific Palisades in the early 70s, and she wanted to sue the church and so on, which I declined to do. But in getting to know her, I talked to her many times. There was definitely some bitterness towards her uncle who had, as she would have allowed her to be executed.
Yeah. Yeah. Newell has has tried to make the case that he engineered it. I've seen no evidence to substantiate that, and I've been through Newell's files on that as well. It's a leap that I haven't been able to make. I just don't think it's justified. On this issue of tolerance, we've talked about the left end of the spectrum. On the right end, you had mentioned Bruce McConkie. It was very interesting what his response to that was. Ultimately, he had to take action, and his initial action was going to be severe. He told his counselors that he had considered releasing him as a general authority. He also said that he had considered requiring him to write a letter of apology to any person who had purchased his book. So it was very severe. But in taking the matter up, he finally told the other general authorities that the book would not be republished, and it wasn't for another 8 years. And then circumstances changed and the second edition came out. But he said, we must be careful that we do not do anything to Brother McConkie that would compromise his ability to carry out his calling. So a very humane man, very ethical man. Another example of his ethics was in probably the most important policy change that happened during his administration, and that was the reversal of the policy, doctrine, call it what you will, of gathering. That under him, the church really did become international. Before, we had a church in many lands that fed converts into the United States. He was the one who said, now you stay where you are and you build the church there. Zion is wherever you are. But he would not make that statement until he first had made the decision and made the announcement, we will have a temple in Europe. Because to him, it would have been unethical to tell them, stay where you are, if that meant depriving them of blessings that they could have had if they had come here. This was quite a man. Yes, Gene.
I can't help reflecting on the irony of your earlier implication that his own tolerance may have acted against his ultimate purposes in some cases.
Yeah,
I think
it did.
McConkie's, I mean, it's becoming clearer and clearer to me that the chief undermining of the good President K. did in changing our attitudes toward the black has been his book. And
yeah.
It's still published, if you can believe this, a book which says all other races are a degenerate form of the white race. That is still being published by
Israel. Which is all part of the same company now.
But that's the exact case, that I think, the way you said that.
Yeah.
That tolerance may have undercut his own greatest.
Yeah, there were some soft spots there that came back to haunt us. Given most of the other alternatives, it's still, I think, the preferable one, but you wish that some of those things would have gotten fixed earlier. It certainly would have saved a lot of trauma. And when he. On occasion, when he did act, he acted very precipitously, and then there was personal damage done. Certainly the way that the first presidency was rearranged in 65 did a lot of damage and could have been handled differently. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.